Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the former editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe and the greatest living American writer. We have a typically fine show for you this week. We're going to talk to Book and Film Globe contributor Laura Pruden. We have an excellent conversation with her about the new movie, The Invite, from director Olivia Wilde. Very funny sex farce set in San Francisco. Reminds me of a sort of classic 70s movies, Woody Allen movies, other sex farce type movies about people of that social class. And Laura and I have a great conversation about that coming up. But first, Stephen Darren is here to talk to me about Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey, which we have long been waiting for and is probably the movie of the summer. I have a lot of criticisms of it, as I always do. Stephen liked it more than I did. You'll find out everything you need to know about The Odyssey right after this interlude. All right, Stephen Garrett, in the tradition of Christopher Nolan and in tribute to his new movie, The Odyssey, we're going to start this interview kind of like toward the end of the interview, of the review, and then we're going to flash back to somewhere in the middle of it, and then we're going to circle back to the end and then back to the beginning and then back to the... Nobody's going to know where we are in our conversation.
I would appreciate that, and I think there should be some kind of weird twist that nobody sees coming, but is
right. And also, you know, let's save the most important scene until the end. How about that? The most important points that we make are going to come at the end. Yeah. So obviously, we're talking here about The Odyssey, the long-awaited mega literary blockbuster, the sword and sandals movie of our time from director Christopher Nolan. An event, a true event, a true cinematic event, unlike anything we've seen since Barbenheimer. I would say this thing's going to be, it was 3 hours long. Nobody left their seat in my theater. It's a story of a father and son who sat next to me, like Odysseus and Telemachus, but they just ate an endless series of disgusting smelling snacks, just vinegary snacks that they're scraping their bowls with their forks. They're smacking their lips like pigs in Cersei's hut. It was
That sounds like
disgusting.
That sounds like the Alamo. That just sounds like an average night at the Alamo. Isn't every night at the Alamo like that?
I mean, I usually go on like Tuesday on a 2 in the afternoon, so no. It's usually just me alone in row three with my bowl of complimentary popcorn that I got because I won a snack pass at trivia night. But yeah, when you go to the Alamo for prime time, it's just like people guzzling food like pigs. But that doesn't really have anything to do with the movie. The movie. Now, Mike, you know, look, I read your review in Book and Film Globe, The Odyssey. Obviously, Christopher Nolan is not a filmmaker to be taken lightly. You must admire him. You must pay homage to the great master of our time.
It's hard to hate anything he's trying to do because he does it with such vigor and sincerity and intelligence and earnestness. You know, I find it very hard to be snarky or dismissive.
I find it really easy to be snarky about everything, and I'm not going to be. But I'm not going to be dismissive of The Odyssey because it's a serious effort by a serious filmmaker. And there's some seriously great shit in it. Like the Cyclops sequence is amazing. The Cersei sequence.
His face is amazing. Dude, his face. I've never seen Cyclops. What a great idea to kind of disfigure him that way. Or refigure him. I don't want to be ableist. I think they actually got out the original RKO King Kong fist, his hand, so he could reach out and grab people. That's the practical effect they used. No.
Yeah. Well, amazing.
Amazing.
Whatever it was amazing. The Cersei
brilliant
segment in Cersei's hut was
all
amazing. Probably that, you know, and Samantha Morton as Cersei was.
They should make new awards.
She's going to get many awards, many nominations.
Ugh, the best character, I think, the best, and done in the most compressed time. It's so elegant. It's so concise. It's so deeply, profoundly disturbing, you know? And it's the best female character in a movie that is absolutely devoid of good female characters, if you ask me.
Yes.
Cersei's the only one. She's the only one.
Right. Like, I thought that Charlize Theron looked good as Calypso. She was wearing a nice... She was wearing a lovely beach wrap and some net shirt or whatever.
It looked weirdly bloodstained, didn't it? A little bit?
Well, maybe, you know.
Design choice.
Possibly. But she looked fantastic.
Kind of a betrayal of the... But like, isn't Calypso... That whole relationship's supposed to be a lot sexier than it was. Isn't it?
Christopher Nolan is never... He's not a sexy... He doesn't do sex.
He's never had sex. He doesn't really do violence. I doubt that. But his movies feel very... I was talking to somebody about it, and he was like, you know, Chris Nolan's movies are very PG. You know what I mean? Like, the violence is never really graphic, and there's no sex.
They're PG-13. Yeah,
okay, PG-13. Because, like, Matt Damon drops an F-bomb.
They're not PG.
Matt Damon says fuck at one point, so that gets in the PG-13.
Yeah. PG is the never-ending story, you know? It's like, you know, the Cyclops is, like, biting people's heads off, though. Those giant, whatever they're called, those giant soldiers, those guys are scary as hell. You know, the Scylla and Charybdis scene was short but good. All the major set pieces of the Odyssey, I thought, were really handled well. My problem with the movie, well, first of all, the non-linear narrative.
You've got notes. Homer is non-linear. That's like the whole thing is that's out of order. Like that's being more faithful to the book than not, don't you think?
No. Yeah, but I mean, you're really going to see the fall of Troy at the end to reveal to us that Odysseus has PTSD.
Spoiler. Duh. But wait, we see it a couple of times.
Come on.
Well, I guess not. But dude, that's the most PG version of the Sad Game of Troy. It was supposed to be this devastatingly traumatic event, and I'm like, I don't see much raping, and I guess there's kind of pillaging, but it's all very, like, made for TV. You know what I mean?
I think those were outtakes from the Kevin Sorbo Hercules series.
It really was kind of tame. I was like, buddy, really, this upset you? I don't understand. You know, I guess it was violence.
Didn't we almost have it? I almost expect him to sing Whitney Houston's Didn't We Almost Have It All. I don't like the nonlinear narrative. Obviously, it doesn't bother you because you have a much more sophisticated sense of storytelling.
No, but the original text, I struggled and failed to try to read the original source material before the movie came out. Like it was
at least they didn't do the naming of ships.
We didn't have to deal with that. And it also, I mean, if anything, I think he clarifies it and streamlines it and makes it a little more chronological than the actual text itself, which is all over the place.
All right. Well, but again, like it's full of great set pieces. That last 30 minutes is fantastic. Whatever. It's going to get what it gets and it won't get upset. But it also, to me, like it had a very uneven roster of performances. Like I thought Matt Damon as Odysseus did his job, was good. He did his job. I thought Anne Hathaway wasn't given much to do with. There were a few of her line readings made me laugh out loud. They were so clumsy.
But for me, you could imagine
her as someone I would personally make an effort to come home to her.
She's just a little too. She's not quite. I think if there was Florence Pugh, that would be a little more regal, a little bit more command.
Florence Pugh.
You know, there was a movie called The Return that came out a couple years ago where Julia Binoche was Penelope. I'd buy that, but like Anne Hathaway, lightweight. I'm sorry. She's got a goofy grin. She just looked more like annoyed.
I thought that John Bernthal was lousy as Menelaus. I thought he was almost speaking with a Brooklyn accent.
Is he a good actor?
Apparently not.
Expect a lot from that guy.
No, but you did have to deal a lot with Tom Holland as Telemachus, and I thought he was very mediocre.
He's like. You know,
my dad's coming home.
My dad. But the thing is, Telemachus doesn't have much to do in the story. Like, what the hell does he do? He doesn't do much.
I know, but you gotta...
These are not great characters to begin with.
No, the great character, though, was John Leguizamo. as that blind.
That was a pretty good character. Yeah,
he was great. You know, he gets an A. Samantha Morton gets an A+. I thought Himesh Patel.
A+.
I thought Himesh Patel was not bad. As you know, he was fine. As but really, like at the end of the day, you know, you're looking at Leguizamo, Samantha Morton, and the Cyclops. Are those your top three characters?
I would say Robert Pattinson, who was fantastic. I thought he was great. That was some good acting. Less is more acting, as opposed to Anne Hathaway, where like every little twitch of her face was like aching to like, you know, emote, you know. And our Pats is like looking at her like
Anne Hathaway wanted to be in the 1955 version of this with Kirk Douglas.
That makes more sense.
So bad. And you know what? I kind of found myself missing those kinds of Sword and Sandals movies. The ones with the Ray Harryhausen special effects. The ones that are just barely concealed metaphor for homosexual longing. You know, I found myself missing those kinds of movies. Because you know why, Steven? Those movies are fun to watch.
Well, this is not fun. This is a movie about trauma. It's a movie about trauma. And you know what? War is hell. War is hell, and don't forget it. And you know what? You might have thought the Trojan horse is a really cool metaphor for crazy stuff that goes down in your life, but it's the root of his trauma. And it was a very sad, traumatic thing that happened.
I would have liked to have seen a little more gee whiz adventuring. I mean, I understand all of his men die. Okay, give it. This is the Aegean Sea. Make it blue.
Did you find though that, like, speaking of his men, none of which have any sort of personality or character, and you don't discern them, and you don't miss them when they die or get eaten by giants or whatever. They seem to like an accordion. They seem to expand and contract depending on how many men they need in any particular moment. You know what I mean? Like it looks like he only has like 20 guys, and then suddenly he's got 150 guys, and then he's got 70 guys, and then he's got 12 guys. And I'm all for things out of
it's like at the end of the baseball season when the roster used to expand and suddenly you had 40 guys in the dugout. That's true. And also, I want to talk about Athena. First of all, there's no gods in this movie. The Zendaya as Athena is not really Athena. She's the ghost of a priest of Athena who Matt Damon witnessed. You know, so
psych. There are no... Spoiler. Psych.
Boring. Twist. I want Ursula Andress up there in the fucking clouds with her in her 90. I want Claire Bloom and Maggie Smith, like in Clash of the Titans, Claire Bloom and Maggie Smith moving the chess pieces around the board. I want
Laurence Olivier as Zeus. You know, I want my Zeusian Olivier. But that was that movie. And incidentally, I love that old.
Me Clash too.
Titans. Give me a break. That was like so good, so good.
Yeah.
Nah, but this is like not meant to be that. I found this to be very affecting and very much a. You know, a very much a worthy sort of successor to and kind of, you know, kindred spirit of Oppenheimer, you know, talking about unleashing a power and destroying a civilization based on what you did, you know, because of the demands of war and the ingenuity that war, you know, inspires in people who are haunted by their choices afterwards, you know.
Sure.
I think there's a nice through line there, and it fits very well into, you know, his other, you know, kind of more recent movies that are more serious. I don't think we're ever going to get another like Dark Knight out of him. You know, like that's serious but super fun.
Why so serious? Speaking of Dark Knight,
why so serious?
Where was the mechanical owl? Where was the flying horse?
That was fun. I miss Pegasus.
Yeah, I mean, why was Hades such a drag? You know, my wife loves that Percy Jackson show on Disney Plus. She's watched it twice. Twice. All the way through. And she's like, oh, because it's fun. The gods are fun. Greek myth is fun. People don't love it because it's about war trauma. I agree with you. I think that it's a fun, an excellent film, worth discussing, worth studying. What it's not is fun.
It would have been an interesting choice if there were a couple soldiers on the beach there before they like stormed Troy, who were just like jackasses, who were like having a blast. We're like, just, yeah, war's great.
Well, whatever. Funny.
That's crazy.
Just some, I understand, a mix.
Like fun, like Dunkirk? Do you have more fun at Dunkirk?
Dunkirk was not fun. Dunkirk was not fun. Not fun. Too much Tom Hardy in an airplane for me and Dunkirk.
That's true, actually. Yeah, that's a very good point.
I want a variety of emotions in a film, not just existential dread. Which is what the Odyssey specializes in. And this is me. Like I'm a dipshit, Steven. I can't help it. This is the same complaint I had when we talked about Supergirl last week. It's, I mean, obviously the Odyssey and Supergirl don't even belong in the same, sentence. I expect to just put them in the same sentence, but it's the same thing. Like everything's grim, dark, everything's serious.
I think you're very excited to see the new Spider-Man movie that's coming out in a couple weeks. That should be a little bit more fun.
That's more my color. That's more my color palette, I'll admit.
Although that's a real reunion for that could be a sequel to The Odyssey because it's got Zendaya and it's got that Brenthal guy.
And Tom Holland.
Well, of course, yes. And Tom Holland.
And Samantha Morton as Cersei.
She should only be in at least she should be required to be in at least four other movies as that character.
Every other movie should have a 15
climaxing in Dune. She should be in Dune Part 3. They should reshoot.
I would put a 15-minute scene of Cersei in every movie from now on. doesn't matter what the genre, you know, if it's some like, you know, apartment sex comedy thing, you know, then Cersei's their next door neighbor and she gives them soup and turns them into animals.
I mean, how great is that, man? Yeah. Like, there are no small roles. Like, it is just astounding how good she just comes in and kicks ass and then just like, boom.
And then she's gone.
Back into your disguises. Back into your disguises. Ooh. Chilling. Yeah. Chilling.
Great performance.
She shoves her whole arm down that dude's throat. Ugh.
She's a witch, baby.
Massaging people's faces into like a boar. Oh my god!
Good
that
stuff.
Was intense, man. Oh,
good stuff. Good
people,
stuff.
There was a lot of A game going on in this movie. You got it.
There were moments where I was like, "This is what movies are about," and then there are moments where I was like, "This is what movies should not be." So you know, real mixed bag. But now Steven, but what was nice about the movie is when I came home. My dog recognized me. You and I have both had dogs die on us, but we've never been to war. We've never been to war, but we have seen The Odyssey, and you should see it too. Probably see it. I did not see it on IMAX. You probably should. Steven Garrett. You'll follow me anywhere to the ends of the earth, and you're not making it home alive. I'll talk to you later.
Okay.
One of the best things about having been away from Book and Film Globe for a while and then coming back is that our new editor, Dan Friedman, has brought in all these terrific new writers, and I get to talk to people who I haven't talked to before on the podcast, and we are lucky enough to have Laura Pruden with us today. She wrote a review of the new Olivia Wilde, I guess we'll call it an Olivia Wilde movie, The Invite, which is all the rage among the chattering classes, both online and off. Cocktail coffee party movie of the moment. And Laura's here today to talk to me about The Invite. Hello, Laura.
Hi there. Hi, Neil. Thanks for having me on.
Hi. Yeah. So well, it's not that kind of invitation, Laura. We'll see how it goes. You gave this movie very high marks, and I went into it with somewhat jaundiced eyes. I go into most movies, but I have to say, like, I was extremely impressed by The Invite. It reminded me of sort of classic 70s sort of sex comedy movies like Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice or Carnal Knowledge, even to some extent like The Graduate, although it wasn't as stylized. But it had that same sort of arched eyebrow about sort of bourgeois sexual mores, and I thought it was really really smart.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it also, I mean, it brings Woody Allen to mind as well for me.
Yes, yes.
And I think, you know, it's interesting. It felt like a little bit European. And I actually saw the movie with my octogenarian mother, and my 20-year-old kid, and we all enjoyed it, so that says something. But my mom immediately mentioned, she goes, "Oh, it just sort of reminded me of some French film. It seems a little European." And it's adapted from a Spanish film. So it is an English language version of a Spanish film that was based on that filmmaker's play.
And yeah, I would say like it kind of exhibits like, well, first of all, Penelope Cruz is one of the main characters, so it makes some sense that it feels a little Spanish, a little Euro. But it sort of displays like I would call it kind of Euro sexual mores, right? Like the premise is that they're Olivia Wilde and Seth Rogen, who personally I think it overdoes it a little bit in the movie, although you know your mileage might vary, mileage may vary, but they play this kind of creative class couple in San Francisco who are on the rocks, and they Olivia Wilde's character invites their upstairs neighbors, played by hilariously by Edward Norton and Penelope Cruz, o over for dinner. But it's very clear they've spent a lot of time listening to them, their neighbors have very loud upstairs sex, and they're clearly couples curious, let's say, in one way or another. So you know, and I'm curious about how the other generations you saw this movie reacted to it, because it felt to me like this was a very millennial movie. Like Olivia Wilde and Seth Rogen are millennials, and Edward Norton and Penelope Cruz they're older, and they're more Gen X. And I would say Penelope Cruz's character is based on the sex therapist Esther Perel, or someone like Esther Perel, and they have a much go ahead.
Who's older? Yeah.
Who's older? But they have a much looser, more continental, more open relationship, and a much more casual attitude in some ways about sex than the other two characters who invite them over, who are very repressed. And you know, I'm just curious, like what does a Gen Z 20 something say about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, so it was my kid. So we didn't
Sure.
really talk a lot about the sex.
Yeah.
But like, I think that she loved just a lot of, there's this wonderful element in the film where Penelope Cruz and Ed Norton's characters speak Spanish to each other. And my kid is very fluent in Spanish. And so there's a lot that operates, I think, on a whole second level, even with just like pronunciation of words, like the word flan. Like, do you say flan or do you say flan? No, say I say flan, you know, that sort of thing. Like 2 days later, my child was like, flan, you know, just because there are these like little tiny, there are these, they get in there on a sort of micro level with each other. And I think that intimacy, which is beyond just sexual, which is actually the more interesting thing in the film, whether it's for humor or for sort of exposure or discovery, you know, that's what makes the movie
Good.
interesting.
Well, that intimacy, Laura, is like to me what makes those two characters have sexual chemistry. I mean, yes, they're Edward Norton and Penelope Cruz. They're beautiful movie stars, but it's that sort of intellectual, personal intimacy that they have that Seth Rogen and Olivia Wilde's characters, who have been married much longer, have lost
Yes. Well, I think
completely.
watching it, I think that the married couple, because the people upstairs are actually not married,
Right.
Although they're in a committed relationship, but Seth Rogen and Olivia Wilde, they are not able to give each other what the other person needs. They just can't. And both of the other, you know, the others, when they couple off, what they give is what the person needs. They listen. You know, Ed Norton listens and really pays attention. And, you know, Penelope Cruz kind of throws some rules out the window and lets him be free, you know. And those are the things that their partners won't and can't do. And so they are really, it really is a flirtation of the mind and sort of emotional more than physical. Even if, yes, Seth Rogen's character has totally ogled Penelope Cruz in the elevator, you know.
Well, who wouldn't?
I mean, it would be hard not to.
Right.
Exactly. And I will say, as far as, you know, just to circle back to his performance, I think that, you know, it's interesting because he's in the company of the ensemble is very strong. And I do feel like it's one of his strongest performances I've seen. I feel like it's one of Olivia Wilde's strongest performances I've ever seen. I really think she's...
I thought she was the standout of all the ensemble. Because, I mean, obviously Penelope Cruz and Edward Norton were great, but they also are very experienced screen actors who we would expect that level of performance from them. But Olivia, I mean, her character was, to me, the most difficult because she was the most frustrated and the most lost and the most conflicted. And you could just see the desire just like oozing out of her pores. The desire for anything.
Yeah. And she also actually harbors the biggest secret in the film.
Yes. Well, which we won't reveal here.
No. Of course not. But she's the kind of person who's just sort of absolutely struggling to maintain composure and control and, facade and or whatever, hoping her insides will match her outside if she keeps it together, and having that exposed is just like, you know, she has a lot at stake. It's a really interesting film.
It's an interesting film. And first of all, let's also add she directed this movie.
No, she directed it.
Yeah,
and there's this like wonderful dichotomy of how on screen she's just, you know, at risk of falling apart at any moment. But she's directing it with this sure hand. Mm-hmm. I mean, these really specific choices. I expect she has a close relationship with a director of photography. But just everything is just so deliberate, even in order to feel, you know, natural, whatever. When you're working with a limited space like that and some handheld work, and it's just extraordinary that she was popping back and forth on either side of the lens is amazing.
It's one of the best directed movies I've seen in a long time. And also, let's add, you know, and the thing that really pushes it over the top to me, I think the script is excellent, really specific, really pointed, really full of turns, small subtle
first
turns.
First rate.
By Will McCormick. That's not the guy from Will and Grace, right?
I always want to say that, but it isn't. But he's an experienced screenwriter. I'm not able to bring any of his films to mind at this very moment. But
it's a great screenplay. I could recommend this movie without reservations.
Totally.
It is like Seth Rogen dropped in from on his day off from shooting Pineapple Express or whatever, and is still like...
Okay, well, I'm going to push back on that a little bit.
Okay.
Because I do think the other thing is, realistically, if you took Joe Dude, who just came home on a sweaty bike ride, and put him in his house and had Penelope Cruz pull him aside...
And stick her chest in his face. Yeah.
He might... be really goofy and stupid.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know how many people would be like cool. And I do think that even though, and they also like the script calls, they literally have him do pratfalls. You know what I mean? So on the one hand, you can be like, I don't know if it's a chicken or an egg kind of situation. And I personally enjoyed his performance. And interestingly, since we talked about generation responses, my mother loved his performance, which he was the only one she didn't know going in. So I was like, what? So who knew? But I will say, because I think this is maybe a larger conversation, but my mother was not scandalized by the film in the slightest. And that might be because she lived through those movies of the 70s. You know what I mean? Like, we go in, you know, things ebb and flow. And, she, you know, she went to Hair and everybody got naked. She was scandalized then. That was shocking. But since then, she's been around for a long time.
Well, it's kind of it's the modern version of the key parties. I don't know.
My mom's older than that.
Right, but she saw it happening. But you know, I it's none of my business what the people in your personal life do, or none of my business what the people in my personal life do. But I know a lot of people who are like kind of quote unquote practicing polyamory, or dancing around it. There was that Miranda July movie, and it's and this movie I think is a very knowing satire, and to some extent a celebration of, but also a satire of our modern screwed up sexual mores. And I feel like it doesn't condemn the lifestyle, but it certainly also points out that it has pitfalls. I wanted to say, like, you know, as a Gen Xer, it's nice to see the millennials, us getting our revenge on these screwed up millennials who just I was like, I told you so. I told you it was going to happen. But oh no, you had to have your gawker.
No, it's true. And I think it's funny, you know, and that shift sort of happened quickly. I'm on the tail end of Gen X. 5 years after me, people were getting married in college. I was like, what is happening? Do you know? And there are a lot of reasons for that, forces, you know, that be in the world. But I think, there are a lot of sort of holier than thou kind of stuff going on. And yeah, it turns out life is long if you're lucky. So, you know, maybe some adventures are ahead.
If you're lucky, Penelope Cruz, sex therapist, lives above you in your San Francisco apartment. Most of us don't have those kinds of opportunities, nor do we really want them.
Speak for yourself. No, I'm kidding.
Well, okay. I can only speak for myself. That's all. It's the only voice I have, Laura. And again, whatever you do when you're not at the movies or on this podcast is none of my business. I don't care who your neighbors are. Regardless, like, of what anybody's doing in the bedroom, you know, pretty much everybody in our sort of general circles and social class is seeing the invite, and I think it'll be a good litmus test. A good litmus test for, you know, for them.
And I will say
their opinions about it.
I agree with the term sex farce. A lot of people call it a sex farce, and I'm like, yeah, like I don't disagree with that at all. But I do think, you know, it opens with that Oscar Wilde quote. I'm going to get close. You know, everyone deserves to be happy, which is why you should in love. Everyone deserves to be happy in love, which is why one should never marry. Right. Close. And and ultimately it opens and closes with this idea of choosing to be with somebody. Right. Yes. And that's what happens. And the people upstairs, they're choosing also, you know, everyone is, free will is actually a big theme in the film.
And the movie doesn't judge, you know, and I've been married for 26 years. I did not see this with my wife because she said the premise didn't appeal to her, but I think she would have actually liked it. And we would have had a very long and passionate argument about it. I'm sure.
Right. I mean,
which is why we're still
there. There you go. But that's the whole thing. I mean, really, right? Communication, like all these buzzwords that people like Esther Perel would say, like communication is the key, you know, it's the ultimate. And in this film, you see it. It's like, oh, that's the foreplay, right? And so it does shed light on things. I don't want to give anything away, but it's a very – and meanwhile, the journey is super fun. Like I had a ball. Yeah. I really enjoyed it.
Great movie. I've not been invited to a dinner party in many years, but they've never been as interesting as that.
Didn't it feel kind of like this, okay, with or without the sex or the keys or whatever, but to me, it felt like, oh, this great kind of post-pandemic film where, like, you can have people over and you can all sit close to each other. You know?
Well, I will say this. I lived in Texas during the pandemic, and for a lot of us, we had people
over. Did you inside? Listen to me, I was scandalized. I lived in New York. I lived in Harlem, and we talked on the stoop. And can I just say, I was so glad that all my neighbors liked to go outside and we could chat. It was really nice. But
I did a lot of things that would scandalize. But you know, I have free will, and look at us. We both survived to go see The Invite. Laura, I'm so glad you're writing for the site. I'm very happy to have you on the show. Let's do it again sometime.
I would love that, Neil. Thank you very much for the invitation.
You are invited. Bye bye. All right. Thank you so much, Laura Pruden. Great to talk to you. The Invite is in theaters now, and it will be on streaming services probably sooner than it should be, but soon. And, you know, it's definitely a return to adult relationship comedy, which I think the movies desperately need right now. Also, thanks to Stephen Garrett for talking to me about The Odyssey from Christopher Nolan. If you go see it today, you might make it home in 20 years or so. It is definitely, you got to see it. You got to see The Odyssey. Even if you don't love it, you got to see it. Everyone's going to see it. I'm Neil Pollack. I am the former editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe. I am the host of this podcast, which we do twice a month these days, and it's always great. And I know you love it. You've been listening to it since we started doing it in 1965 or something like that. And you know, we're going to keep doing it as long as CA Reads Media allows us to. Our new theme song and incidental music are by composer Matthew Sheffer and licensed for use by Sea of Reeds Media. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening. I will talk to you next time. Audio.